From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the December 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Easterly wind, rain. On the 7th of December 1941, Japanese invasion forces landed in Malaya. An hour and a half later, Japanese aircraft attacked the US fleet at anchor in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Simultaneous attacks were also made on Hong Kong, Guam, Wake Island, and the Philippines. Since that day, controversy has raged over how much the British and US governments knew in advance about these attacks and why they came as such a surprise to both countries. In this It Happened Here episode, Dr. David Kenyon examines the intelligence background to the Day of Infamy and explores just what British and US codebreakers really knew about Japanese plans.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
David, as we're releasing this episode, it's the 80th anniversary of the infamous attack on Pearl Harbor. But we're going to look at not just Pearl Harbor, but the other events around Pearl Harbor, because people think that Pearl Harbor was this one event, but it was a whole attack across the Pacific by the Japanese. But can you give us a bit of background to how we got to where we were on December the 7th?
I can. And in a way, the first thing I'm going to say is Pearl Harbor is remembered as an enormous surprise. And it's somehow a treacherous kind of, they hadn't declared war or whatever. The first point to make is that the idea that there might be a war with Japan, either by the Americans or by the British, cannot have been a surprise to anybody. The bigger principle that Japan is likely to attack us wouldn't have been at all surprising. That everyone was kind of expecting that. There'd been tension in the region for decades almost. I mean, you go right back. The situation in Japan was that their military in particular, and there was a group within their politicians who became increasingly belligerent and increasingly imperialistic. And they had ambitions to expand Japanese influence throughout Southeast Asia. The first thing they do is invade Manchuria, which is the top right-hand corner of China, more or less opposite Japan. And they occupy Korea after the Russo-Japanese War in 1905. So they're building a bit of a sort of mainland empire up there. And that stabilized the situation for a bit. But then in 1937, they militarized again and attacked the rest of China, Chiang Kai-shek's government in what we refer to as nationalist China. And that's in 1937. And there are some, I might say they're pedants, some historians will argue that the correct date of the beginning of World War II is 1937.
There is a bit of a revisionism about the start of the war, isn't there?
Because the combat by the parties that fight the war, the first fighting starts in 1937. But then you could say the Italians invaded Abyssinia in 1935. So, you know, where do you draw the line?
Or even the Spanish Civil War.
And certainly, as far as Britain is concerned, it's September 3rd, 1939. But the Chinese begin fighting the Japanese again in 1937. And so for years, there's this tension in what they would have called at the time the Far East in South and Southeast Asia. So war with Japan wouldn't have been terribly surprising. One of the interesting factors is that the Americans, who had then very strong interests in East Asia, were very unhappy about what the Japanese were doing. And their response to it was to impose economic sanctions. This all sounds quite modern. So they imposed economic sanctions on Japan. The problem is that Japan was getting fuel oil and aviation fuel in particular from the United States. They were getting steel from the United States. They were getting a lot of the materials they needed specifically for war making from the Americans. And so in a way, the American sanctions made the Japanese even more annoyed, if you like, rather than making them want peace.
Because Japan's quite a resource poor country, isn't it?
It is. And a lot of their imperial ambitions are based on the idea that they are resource poor. So if they can expand into Vietnam, Thailand, Malaya, there's rubber. Further south in the Dutch East Indies, there's oil. There's all sorts of good stuff to be had if you're an expanding industrial economy, which Japan is. If you want to do a modern parallel, and this struck me the other day, you can compare it to the US relations with Iran today. Because you have a power that's in a region that America's interested in, that is potentially expansionist. And the American response is to impose loads of sanctions on it. And all the American sanctions on Iran has done is really annoy them.
And made them more belligerent.
Made them more belligerent. And kind of the same thing is happening to Japan. So in 1941, it's not really a surprise to anybody if a war's going to happen. But there are big diplomatic efforts to try and prevent it. And although diplomatic relations had been broken off and Japan didn't have an ambassador in the United States at the time, they did send a diplomatic delegation to the United States in November 1941 to try and, you know, come to some kind of, we won't start a war if you take away your sanctions. It all becomes very chicken and egg.
What's the British involvement at this time? Because we've gone through the Battle of Britain. We've kind of got over the invasion scare. Hitler's turned his sights on Russia 6 months ago. Britain is mainly fighting in the Western Desert, aren't they?
Yes, and at this period, in the back end of 1941, December 1941, Operation Crusaders just happened. The Germans and the Italians are kind of on the back foot in North Africa. You know, Benghazi is back in British hands, albeit briefly. So things aren't going too badly there. Barbarossa has happened, as we've discussed. Interestingly, some of the intelligence for Barbarossa comes exactly from Japanese diplomatic traffic, which we're going to talk about in a little bit.
Are our eyes off the ball in the Far East?
Yes and no. I mean, they have been monitoring the Japanese intensively since the end of the First World War. During the First World War, the Japanese were on the Allied side and were friendly. And if you go back further, the Russo-Japanese War, 1905, there were Royal Navy officers on board the Japanese ships when they were fighting the Russians. Jackie Fisher, who develops his ideas about dreadnoughts, actually has those ideas while he's out in Japan.
Oh.
But in the 1920s and the 1930s, you get the Washington Naval Treaties where the three big naval powers in the world are Britain, the USA, and Japan. And so those treaties are all about parity between the nations.
Yeah.
Well, I say parity, the Royal Navy being bigger than everybody else.
Yeah.
So the relationship with Japan deteriorates from kind of 1918 onwards. And as the nationalist mood rises in Japan, the Royal Navy in particular keep an ever-increasing eye on the Japanese.
Because the Japanese Navy at this point is being built up into a very modern navy.
Oh, yes. It's a very modern and very powerful navy. I mean, it is the third navy in the world. The comparison might be with Italy, where the Italians, Mussolini builds a very modern navy in the 1930s. But while the Italians have very good ships, they have very inexperienced sailors because their navy has not had much experience and, you know, they have competency issues. But the Japanese Navy has been great since the turn of the century. There's nothing wrong with the Japanese at sea. They're good at what they do. So they are a genuine threat from that point of view. And so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about it today, but the British have been listening to Japanese codes and breaking Japanese codes, on the naval side in particular, since the late 1920s. I mean, you have this sort of division of labour that the Navy look after the Far East, the Army look after the Middle East, and the RAF look after the UK.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of where their principal zones of interest are, and you see the responsibility kind of shaking down.
I've not thought of it like that, yeah.
That home defence is really an RAF thing, and the Army is concerned with the Middle East, and the Navy deals with the Far East. In terms of taking their eye off the ball, the problem you have is that 2 years into the war, all of the British military is very stretched, and the Royal Navy in particular. The Eastern Fleet has been eroded by ships being sent to other places. And there are several points where there are kind of arguments between the commander of the Eastern Fleet and Churchill and everybody else about the Eastern Fleet. And you could argue that part of the problem in the Far East is that the British government don't put enough actual assets on the ground. You can say, oh, yes, it's all right, we've got an Eastern Fleet. But this question is, how big is the actual Eastern Fleet? Is it 10 battleships or is it one? You know, and if you've gradually whittled away the battleships in it till it is only one, then although it's still nominally the Eastern Fleet, it's not actually very good for anything.
And is that happening across the board in all the branches? You know, is the RAF not getting enough planes in the East? Are the Army not getting enough men and tanks and machine guns?
It is a bit like that, yeah. They're having to draw down the garrisons there. And the RAF, for example, in Malaysia isn't flying, you know, Spitfires and Hurricanes, it's flying Buffaloes, which are significantly inferior aircraft. Again, we're not here to talk about Singapore, but Singapore has this reputation as this impregnable fortress, that we don't need to worry about the Far East because we've got Singapore, and no one can ever capture Singapore because Singapore's impregnable. But just saying it doesn't make it so. And the more you degrade your forces there, the less saying it makes it so.
And Singapore is a big naval base for Britain, isn't it?
Yes, it's our main fleet base in the Far East. There was a presence in Hong Kong, but in 1939, they wind down the operation in Hong Kong because they feel it's kind of indefensible.
Mm.
And in particular, the codebreakers, the Far East Combined Bureau, who are the British codebreaking operation, the sort of Bletchley substation, moves from Hong Kong to Singapore in 1939. As it turns out, they have to move out of Singapore pretty quickly subsequently. Yeah. But a lot of the operations we're talking about today in terms of British code breaking are based in Singapore at this point and in what is called the Far East Combined Bureau, but it's more or less run by the Royal Navy.
Right. Is the Middle East Bureau more run by the army then?
It is, yes. There's this sort of division of labour, if you like, because of the differing service interests, that there are RAF people and army people at FECB, but they're not nearly as active as the Navy guys are. So that's the sort of background to what's happening.
The Columbia Broadcasting System now presents a summary of all the important news in the world today. Reports from CBS correspondents by Transatlantic and Transpacific Shortwave Radio, and the latest developments as received by Columbia's newsroom here in New York. And now first, Albert Warner is ready to report the Far East story from our own capital. We take you now to Washington.
Against the dark counter moves of military preparation in the Far East, Washington maintained a grim silence today. White House and State Department waited for the reply which Japan is yet to make to Mr. Hull's note setting forth basic principles for a Far Eastern settlement. They clung to silence on the Japanese note of yesterday, which sought to explain Japanese troop movements into French Indochina. But Tokyo's soft answer had not turned away American suspicion. Washington is not convinced that the troop movements were exaggerated or that they were not bent on new aggression. But several senators read into the Japanese delay a hopeful sign. "I have had the view all along," said Senator George, "that the Japanese do not want to force the issue." I return you now to New York.
And that's the world today. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
So we wake up on December the 7th. Okay, we might not think today is going to be the day, but what happens on December the 7th?
Well, you say you wake up on December the 7th. It kind of depends where you wake up, because in some places it's December the 8th. And this is where this story gets complicated. And what I had to do when I was preparing for this was I looked at the timings of all of the different events and then converted them all into GMT.
So we're not going to have any problems with timings in this episode, listeners. Just always remember, they're all based on GMT.
This is the interesting thing, that people remember the attack on Pearl Harbor. And that attack happened at about 10 to 8 in the morning, Pearl Harbor time, Hawaiian time. So 0748 is the sort of time that gets commonly quoted. On the 7th of December. That is 20 past 6 in the evening in Britain, Greenwich Mean Time. Well, we would have been 1 hour ahead of that in Britain because they had double summertime and they still stayed 1 hour ahead in winter. But yeah, it's the evening in Britain and it's just after lunch. It's 20 past one in Washington, D.C. on a Sunday. And that becomes relevant when we talk about how prepared the Americans were. So 7:48 a.m., Pearl Harbor is attacked. But actually, about an hour earlier, almost exactly an hour earlier, Japanese troops land in Malaya and Thailand. So the first belligerent act that the Japanese do is to do assault landings on the beach in Kota Baru in Malaysia and in Thailand. But that happens at local time, 12:45 a.m. on the 8th of December, because it's already Monday in Malaya and Thailand, but it's still Sunday in Britain, the US and Hawaii, going kind of the wrong way around the world.
We should have warned the listeners about maths questions coming up.
Yes. It's not particularly important. The thing to keep hold of is what time it is in Hawaii and what time it is in Washington. But as a British person, I always like to point out that actually Malaya got invaded first. The Japanese intention was that all of these things should happen more or less simultaneously. And what people forget is that within 12 hours, they're not exactly simultaneous, but basically on the 7th or the 8th, there are attacks on the Philippines, on the island of Guam, on Wake Island, and on Hong Kong. The Japanese aren't just doing Pearl Harbor, they're doing a whole kind of theater-wide operation.
And all these places, we should probably explain, are sort of big bases or territories run by either the British or the Americans,
yes,
aren't they?
I mean, Guam and Wake Island and the Philippines are the three American bases in the Western Pacific. The strategically really important one is the Philippines. That's what, well, the biggest one, if you like. But Guam and Wake obviously have strategic importance as airfields and as harbors for ships and all of that. And Hong Kong, again, is British possession, but it would also give the Japanese a good jumping-off point for their continuing campaign in China. So it makes sense there. And the British kind of know that because they pulled out of Hong Kong already. But there are still intercept operators in Hong Kong, and there is still a small SIGINT presence, and there's still a British presence of various kinds. So there is a very short battle for Hong Kong, and then basically everyone goes into Japanese captivity. It's a rather unfortunate situation. That's what's happening. On the 7th of December, the Japanese say, right, we start the war, we'll attack everybody. And that's what they do. The reason they attack Pearl Harbor in particular is because it's the home of the US Pacific Fleet. So their operations throughout the Philippines and Indonesia and all of these places are going to rely on sea communications. They can't fight their invasions of all these islands without having control of the sea. So the first thing you've got to do is you've got to put the American fleet out of the game.
Because the Americans are the bigger danger to the Japanese than the British, aren't they? Because as you said, we've got a fleet in the Pacific.
But it's not as big as the Americans, because the Royal Navy's tied up in the Mediterranean, the North Sea, you know, they've been off sinking the Bismarck, they've been doing all sorts of things. So the big naval threat is from the US. What's interesting is the reason the Pearl Harbor attack isn't as decisive as the Japanese hoped was that the three fleet carriers that the Americans had in Pearl Harbor happened to be at sea.
Yeah.
And so they survive to fight the war in the Pacific. And we know with hindsight that the naval war in the Pacific became a war of aircraft carriers. But the perception in 1941 was that the most important ships in anyone's navy were the battleships. So even though historic hindsight tells us they were actually obsolete, nobody realized that in 1941. No. So the Japanese would have been very pleased that the American battleships were still there, and sinking American battleships would have seemed great, you know, and the Americans would have felt it. The term capital ships, you know, your main fleet, doesn't describe aircraft carriers.
No.
It only describes battleships. So from that point of view, the attack is successful, but it transpires that naval warfare has changed such that aircraft carriers are actually much more important.
Yeah.
But the point is, they missed the aircraft carriers. Had they sunk a couple of the carriers, the picture could have been very different. So they attack at Pearl Harbor in order to clear the way for their main campaign in Malaya, in the Philippines, etc., etc. And there, for the first 6 months of the war, everything's going really well for the Japanese. I mean, Singapore falls in February 42, so it's within 2 months. All the sort of impregnable fortress idea of Singapore was based on it being attacked from the sea. And so it's very heavily defended on its seaward side. I visited Singapore, and the south coast of the island is covered in these enormous batteries with, you know,
huge naval guns
and things. The problem is, if someone's invaded Malaya already, there's a sort of short strait of rather swampy sea.
It's sort of the back causeway door, isn't it?
It's the back door. And so Britain assumed that Singapore would protect Malaya. Actually, it didn't. And when Malaya is overrun, Singapore falls. So the Japanese have done well there. Equally, the Americans in the Philippines. The Philippines holds on longer, but again, by May 1942, MacArthur pulls out the Philippines, and you know, it's 2-0 to the Japanese at that point. They've got what they want. I mean, things turn around quite quickly, because in the summer you get the Battle of Midway, which puts the Japanese Navy on the back foot, and then, you know, the rest is history. But at this point,
they're kind of unstoppable, aren't they?
They are, and on the 7th, they achieve a lot of the things they set out to achieve.
Here is the news. Japan's long-threatened aggression in the Far East began tonight with air attacks on United States naval bases in the Pacific. Fresh reports are coming in every minute. The latest facts of the situation are these. Messages from Tokyo say that Japan has announced a formal declaration of war against both the United States and Britain. The Japanese air raids were made on the Hawaiian Islands and the Philippines. President Roosevelt has told the Army and Navy to act on their secret orders, has called a meeting of ministers, and is preparing a report for Congress. In London, Mr. Wynant has seen Mr. Churchill, and both Houses of Parliament have been summoned for tomorrow afternoon to hear a statement on the situation.
So do we have a contradiction here, though? Because you've said that this is a surprise attack. All of these attacks are surprise attacks. But you've also said we had a code-breaking presence out in the Far East. I mean, did America have code-breakers working on Japanese codes as well as us, or were they just not breaking any Japanese codes? What's the code-breaking side to this?
Well, this is where we get into the sort of the real complexities of the story. And this is where some of the conspiracy theories that we'll get onto later come from. Because the question is always asked, surely it can't be that much of a surprise. And you have to separate the idea of strategic surprise in the event that you find yourself at war with someone you weren't expecting.
Yeah.
It's not a strategic surprise. No. It is a tactical surprise because they're not expecting Pearl Harbor specifically to be attacked, or that they'll land in Malaysia on that day. Because the thing about military preparedness is you could be prepared on a sort of it's coming at some point level, but you can't be prepared on a it's tomorrow morning level every single day, because you just go mad.
Tomorrow morning on this street here.
Yeah. So they are prepared in the strategic sense that they're expecting that the Japanese might attack them, but they don't know when and exactly how. And this is where the SIGINT comes in. And the code breaking that's been done against the Japanese is being done by both the British and the Americans and the Dutch in the Dutch East Indies. And we've talked about some of this elsewhere in terms of the UK-USA relationship, about how they start to collaborate with each other. But I'll come to that. But the first thing you need to understand is what Japanese codes and ciphers are involved. And that falls into two major groups. You've got the Japanese diplomatic traffic to and from their embassies worldwide. And you've also got the Japanese Navy. Japanese Army, less important, because most of these operations are being mounted from the sea. So the overarching strategic political situation is understood from the Japanese diplomatic. And then the what are they actually going to do is understood or not understood in this case by listening to the Japanese Navy. And the Japanese don't have an air force at this point, so Japanese Navy includes Japanese Naval Air.
Right.
So those are the two main bits to look at. But also both of those bits are being simultaneously attacked by both the British and the Americans.
And are they doing those separately or are they starting to work together?
This is the crucial thing. From February 41, when you have the Sinkoff visit to Bletchley Park and the Americans bring a purple analogue with them, at that point, Britain has been working on Japanese diplomatic separately from the Americans. And it's at that point in the spring of 1941, they start to collaborate.
What's a purple analogue?
The Japanese diplomatic service use a machine cipher, which can be compared broadly to an Enigma machine in the sense that you type letters in and they get transposed into other letters within the machine. And it works on European alphabet. But purple isn't the first machine they use. And this is important because of how purple ultimately gets understood by the Allies.
And these names, these are just names that we've given them.
These are code names that were given by the Americans, yes. They're not what the Japanese call them. I will attempt to give you the Japanese titles, but you'll have to bear with me for my Japanese pronunciation. Back in 1931, the Japanese introduce a mechanical cipher machine, which the Allies know as RED. And this is the Shiki Injiki Type 91. The 91 is the date, because in Japan, at that point, they were using the imperial calendar. And 1931 is 2591 in Japanese calendar. So Type 91 machine, known as RED. The point about the RED machine is, as I say, it's a transposition machine. So you press a key, the letter gets converted into a different letter. But at that time, the Japanese didn't have their own independent cable network. So Japanese diplomatic messages are being sent from Tokyo to wherever, Berlin, London, Washington, D.C., by commercial telegram. And the problem with commercial telegrams is they cost money. And this goes back to the late 19th century. And when telegram communication became popular and everybody was doing it, you pay per letter.
Yeah.
So it's quite expensive. So a lot of people introduced code books, which weren't intended for secrecy. They were simply intended to make the messages shorter.
To save money.
Yeah, you could go to a local bookshop and you could buy a telegraphic code. Which, when you look in it and it would go, you know, arriving on the train tomorrow would be AJP and arriving on the train on Tuesday would be AJR or whatever. So you could send telegrams really quickly and cheaply. The telegram companies found this really annoying because they weren't making enough money. But also, if you're a telegraph operator, if you're tapping out Morse code, if you're presented with a sentence of real words, you can remember them. So you tap it out really easily. But if it's random alphabetic characters, it's more difficult. So it's much slower to do because you have to actually remember each letter. So the telegraph companies made it a rule that if your telegram wasn't pronounceable, it was more expensive. So you get a fresh round of telegraph code books, and some of them use real words as code words for other things. So instead
of saying,
I'll be on the train tomorrow, you say banana or whatever it is. Mm. And you just send banana and that's what it means. But it's shorter,
yeah.
But it's also pronounceable. But a lot of these systems used made-up words that were nonsense, but that had the vowels and the consonants in the right places, that it could be pronounced as syllables. And thus you could get it under the wire as a pronounceable message, even though it was gibberish, because the telegraph operator could read them as pronounceable words and thus could remember them. The point about this is, if you're the Japanese government and you're sending millions of cables every year, if you can make all those cables pronounceable, it's cheaper. So the RED cipher machine, if you press a vowel, it only gets enciphered as another vowel. And if you press a consonant, it only gets enciphered as another consonant.
Oh, that's a help for code breakers, isn't it?
Yeah, you're way ahead of me here. There's six vowels, because they include Y, and there's 20 consonants. And American code breakers refer to these as the 6 and the 20. And the machine was designed so that the ciphertext came out with vowels and consonants as consonants, which meant when you went to the telegraph office, it was cheap to send, etc. But as you say, once you know that, once you figure that out, it makes the breaking of the machine a lot simpler. And the RED machine was broken by GCNCS, back in 1934, a man we might have heard of by the name of Hugh Foss, and Oliver Strachey worked on Bread, broke it, and they built an analog machine to speed up the breaking process, known as the J machine, which I assume stood for Japanese, which is built by Harold Kenworthy, who at that time was working for the Metropolitan Police. Harold Kenworthy crops up a lot because he went on to run the Knockholt intercept station for Colossus, for Fish. But he's kind of one of their go-to tech guys. And Kenworthy builds an analog machine.
I take it one doesn't survive.
No, I'm not aware of that surviving. Of course, in 1934, Britain and America aren't collaborating. So the Americans are working on Red separately. And in 1936, Frank Rowlett, who's a famous American cryptographer, and Solomon Kullback, working for William Friedman, who's the most famous American cryptographer, the US Army Signal Service break Red as well. And they also build an analog machine. I don't know what theirs looks like or whether it was similar to the British one, but basically it means both sides can read Red. Both the US and the UK can read Red in the 1930s, but aren't telling each other at that point because we haven't got to 1941. That's all very well until February 1939, when they both decipher a Japanese diplomatic message transmitted, enciphered in Red, which says, henceforth, from the 20th of February 1939, use the Type B machine, which is a new machine. That machine is the one that's codenamed Purple.
And this is the one that is more famous, isn't it?
This is the famous one, yes. And Purple is distributed around the Japanese overseas diplomatic missions all around the world, and it becomes really, really important. The reason I've told you all the business about Red is because Purple is based on Red. And the Japanese design a system where vowels can now be enciphered as consonants. That weakness has been taken away. But the six vowels, A, E, I, O, U, and Y, still work on a separate channel in the machine from the consonants. People are more familiar with how an Enigma machine works. If you imagine the letter that you press goes into a rotor, changes into a different letter, and then that happens again in the second rotor and the same in the third rotor, and then comes back. The Japanese machine does something similar. It changes the letter three times if it's a consonant, but it only changes it once if it's on the vowel side, even though it can change it into a consonant. You still with me?
Yeah, it just seems daft that they would...
Yeah, it's a bit weird, but you can see how they've taken the first machine and they've adapted it and they've gone, well, this vowel thing is a bit of a problem, let's get rid of that. But they don't get rid of it completely, they just adapt it to read consonants.
Yeah, so they a quick fix sort of thing on it.
But this baffles GCNCS. GCNCS start intercepting Purple traffic, but despite the best efforts of Foss and the rest of them, they don't really make any progress with it, which is very frustrating.
Well, also, I imagine they were slightly more concentrating on the...
Yeah, they started fighting the Germans at that point. So, yeah, they have other things to think about. The Americans, on the other hand, Frank Rowlett and the American team are able to go on from Red to Purple. And they set about breaking Purple. And they analyze the traffic and they realize that even though the vowels aren't necessarily coming out the other end as vowels, they can tell by the frequencies in which letters occur and things that there's still sixes and twenties, as they call them, in the machine. And they break the vowels first.
That's handy.
And then subsequently they manage to break the whole machine and they famously build a Purple analog. And it's one of those machines that comes to Bletchley with the Sinkoff visit in the spring of 1941. So at that point, from Christmas 1940 into spring of 1941, both UK and US can once again read Japanese diplomatic traffic.
These are the gates that were the entrance to Bletchley Park during the Second World War.
The Americans who came here, I know, understood the importance of the building in their time, and I really appreciate the importance of it today. This is like the hometown for both American and British cryptologists.
Yeah. The reason, of course, for the Americans visiting here was that a series of decisions had been made by politicians in the UK and the US,
yes,
that there should be a full exchange between the two countries on technical matters,
yes,
not just in intelligence, but also in things like radar, in advanced gunnery and things like that.
Yes.
And I think it's particularly important to remember that our relationship, the relationship between the SIGINT organisations of the two countries, was part of a much wider relationship.
Yes, but it had solid political support at the top. President Roosevelt had given the Americans authority to share it all, and we came prepared to share as much as we could with our new friends.
Indeed, and it was. My name's Tony Comer. I'm the departmental historian at GCHQ. The irony, of course, is that once the decision had been taken to invite the American cryptanalysts to Bletchley Park, there was nothing really for the people at Bletchley Park to do other than sit and wait. All the arrangements for the travel were made by the Secret Intelligence Service, And all the people at Bletchley Park knew was that the Americans were due to travel on HMS King George V after it had dropped Lord Halifax in Washington to become the new British ambassador. You can imagine the problems that people had here at Bletchley, wondering when these people were ever going to arrive.
My name is David A. Hatch. I'm the historian for the National Security Agency in the United States. The Americans traveled in a British convoy across the Atlantic and were landed in Scapa Flow. The original plan was for the Americans to fly from the Orkneys down to London. However, the crates of cryptoanalytic devices that the Americans had brought would not fit in the designated airplanes, so they had to travel along the east coast of Britain by ship. While they were traveling, this ship was attacked by German aircraft. It was heavily strafed. In addition to the distress caused to the cryptologists, this had an interesting after effect. They were not the first, but they were among the first Americans to come under German fire. When they returned to the United States, not only could they share the cryptanalytic information that they exchanged with the British, but they could talk about the danger, about the urgency, about the threats to convoys as they had sailed across the ocean, and most chilling of all, of being under German air attack. They were landed in London. They were taken overland to Bletchley Park. They were tired. They were perhaps frightened. They were cold and a little bit wet, perhaps, but a warm welcome awaited them at Bletchley Park. They were among colleagues there.
Talking about the purple analog machine, one of the ironies that I find quite amusing about this, because I'm a geek, is the Japanese machine, when I've talked about this transposition of letters, it's not a rotor machine. It doesn't have a wheel in it like an Enigma. What it has is a thing called a uniselector. If you imagine a electrical gizmo that looks like sort of half a cake, it's a sort of semicircular thing.
Okay.
And what it is in telephone exchanges, in old style telephone exchanges, when you rang a number, the electrical pulse would push a needle around the semicircle to make a particular contact. And that swinging arm...
Like the old relays.
Yeah. So if you dialed three, it would go dit, 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 and the needle would move three places around. And these things, they're thick because you'll get a stack of needles.
Ah, this is where the cake comes in. I can see now.
So it's like a semicircular thing and it has a stack of arms and each of those arms can have a number of positions it can stop at on the semicircle. Yeah. And these were very common. They were used in telephone exchanges and telephone exchanges need thousands of them. So they're very, very common electrical components. What they did, what the Japanese did, was they get a bank of six switches. If you imagine stacked on top of one another, you've got six of these semicircles.
Dr. David is painting a picture of an invisible cake at this moment, isn't it?
So each vowel has one uniselector in a stack. And there are 25 contacts around the edge of the ring.
Ah, right. Okay, yep.
So that when you press the key for E, the arm for E moves one position around the semicircle and then sends a current. And around the outside of the semicircle are the letters of the alphabet all mixed up. So basically you press the key, the needle happens to be pointing at, say, J, so it's encrypted as J. When you press the key again, the needle clicks forward one position, and E is encrypted as whatever the next letter is around the circuit. And when it gets to the end, it clicks back to the beginning again.
So all the letters around the edge of this semicircle.
Yeah.
So they're pseudo-random, I take it. And are each of these six different?
Yes, there's a different random sequence on each ring.
Right.
So that as the arm moves, it's equivalent to an Enigma rotor clicking forward one position. So it's creating a different encryption 25 times, and then it goes back to the beginning again. What they do for the consonants is they make a bank of 20 uniselectors. The components they use have six in them, so they get four sixes. So they've got 24 circuits, but they only use 20 of them. And they use those for the consonants. So you've got a six and these 20s. On the 20 side, on the consonant side, you press J, the current goes in, down the arm to whatever the random letter is. But then there's a second bank of uniselectors, so that whatever it's come out of that first one as, say R, it goes into the next one as R, gets transposed again. And then there's a third bank of uniselectors.
So this is like an Enigma.
So it's like going through three rotors in an Enigma machine. So it's doing something very similar to an Enigma. And it also has plug boards. What's more convenient? Well, it's a larger machine than Enigma, but you've got two electric typewriters with a purple machine wired in between them. And what that means is you type on the keyboard of one of them and it prints out the ciphertext on the other one, and vice versa.
This isn't small, is it?
No, it's about the size of of two large electric typewriters with a box in between. The analog is about 4 feet long.
It's not quite like the handy portable device.
No, it's not the handy portable device that an Enigma is. And this is why when the Syncon Visit group turn up in Scapa Flow, they can't fit the thing on the flying boat because it's too big. But the interesting point I was going to, by a very long, circuitous route, is that Leo Rosen, MIT engineer, who comes with the machine to Bletchley in February 41, he was responsible for building the Purple Analog. And at that point, the Signals Intelligence Service in the US military have a paper understanding of the machine. They know what it does, but they don't know exactly how it's built. And Rosen is sitting there going, how could I mimic this process using freely available electrical components? And he goes, I could do that with a telephone exchange unit selector. So he builds his machine out of exactly the same component the Japanese have used to build the original machine without ever knowing.
Yeah.
Because all he's been given is the cryptographic functioning, which I think is really amusing that he's completely accidentally built it out of exactly the same thing the Japanese built it out of, which means no wonder it worked.
Yeah.
That's a very long explanation of Purple, and I will shut up about Purple now. But before I do, just to finish, Steve Budiansky, who is a historian of code-breaking, written some great books, he wrote a book called Battle of Wits, which is, I recommend. He talks about the breaking of Purple in September 1940 in Washington, D.C. And I'll read you his remark. He says, Genevieve Grosjean rushed in to show her results to Rowlett, and soon the commotion and shouting drew everyone in the section. The more cosmopolitan scientists who came from around the world to work on America's Manhattan Project celebrated at times like this with a drink of the distinctly alcoholic variety. Friedman's band of very middle Americans sent out for a round of Cokes.
Britain and America have been in the position where they've both been able to break red. Red stops getting used. There's a panic probably with purple being introduced, but the Americans break purple. So how significant is that moving on from February 41?
It's hugely significant. And we've talked about it on this podcast before, but the ability to read purple has all sorts of ramifications for the whole of the rest of the war. Long-time listeners will remember us talking about General Oshima, the ambassador in Berlin, who is sending purple messages back to Japan, and there's all the stuff around D-Day. In the Barbarossa episode, we talked about how Oshima reported on the German plans to invade Russia. He's basically a commentator from Berlin on all things German.
He does
Japanese
a lot of good work.
He's brilliant. Like we use the term ultra to describe the product of purple is known as magic. And magic is really good stuff. And it has all sorts of significances later. And in 1941, in particular, it's giving us a very strong insight into Japanese diplomatic thinking about potential war in the Far East. So that strategic picture I was talking about, that diplomatic picture, both the British and the Americans are getting a really good insight into that because they're reading Japanese purple. They're also reading other minor diplomatic codes. You know, I'm sort of generalizing. These aren't the only codes in use, but it's the principal one. And here at Bletchley Park, once the machine has arrived, it's set up in Elmer's school, and they have a Japanese diplomatic section in there who are reading this stuff, and it's all going really well.
Who's running that section?
Hugh Foss is involved for some of the time, but then he gets switched back over onto Japanese naval work later on. In 42, when Denniston goes back to London with diplomatic and commercial sections, Japanese diplomatic goes back to London with him. The weird thing about purple in America, and this will crop up later, and we've talked about this in other podcasts, there is an issue in the United States with the US Navy and the War Department, the Army, not wanting to talk to each other. And especially in the signals intelligence field, they are rivals. And Bletchley in 1940, 41, and even later in the war, has to have a sort of tripartite negotiation because they have to talk to the Navy on one hand and they have to talk to the War Department on the other because they don't like collaborating.
The Americans don't have like a GC&CS.
No,
they don't have an override. They don't have, well, today it's the NSA, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's code breakers in the US Navy and there's code breakers in the US Army. Yeah. Purple is so significant and it's been broken by the Army, but the Navy insists they want a part of it. So you end up with a situation where they take turns on alternate days. So traffic comes in, and depending which day of the week it is, it either goes to the Navy or it goes to the Army. And they decrypt it. They still send it to the same people. It goes to the State Department or the President or whoever, but they take alternate days to do it, which is mad.
It's a wonder we won the war, isn't it?
I'll come back to this, because actually the longest message that's sent prior to Pearl Harbor, half the message is decrypted by one side on one day, and the other half of the message is decrypted by the other side on the other day.
You couldn't make this up.
You couldn't make it up. But we'll come back to that. But the bottom line is that on the diplomatic side, UK and US have a pretty good insight into Japanese thinking. The problem with that is that the Japanese military and the warmongers, if you like, have not shared any of their plans for the war with their diplomats.
They're doing this completely separately without them knowing.
Completely separately. So the Japanese diplomats are told, go and negotiate with the Americans to prevent a war, but we're not telling you what happens if it fails.
So is Japan being run by the military in reality?
In reality, yes. Officially, no. Officially, yeah. The emperor is still in charge. Officially, yeah. They have a prime minister. They have a normal civil government. But the military is so powerful behind the scenes that they're basically dictating policy.
And so they have decided they're going to go to war, but it's sort of a smokescreen to send the diplomats off, is it?
I think so. I mean, I don't know enough about the diplomatic side of it to answer that specifically.
That's how it looks, is it?
But that's how it looks. I mean, I think if the diplomats had come back and said, yeah, we've got a deal, there wouldn't necessarily have been a war in December 1941. Yeah. It doesn't mean that the military wouldn't have carried on pushing and they would have invaded the Philippines in 1942. You know, I think the die was cast years before and they certainly weren't going to pull out of China. And given that they were never going to pull out of China, the war was kind of inevitable. But in terms of the tactical plan, the who do we attack, when and where, the diplomats are left out of that.
I'm Stephen Freer, and I came to Bletchley first in 1941. I came from Trinity College at Cambridge. I was reading classics, so that was a good grounding for learning the rudiments of several other languages, such as Italian and Japanese. I went one day to the interview, which was in Oxford, and there for the first time I met Commander Denniston. And the summons to the interview had been sent to my home address, and sometimes in wartime the post was rather slow, so I didn't actually receive it at Cambridge until the morning of the day when I was supposed to be there. And I had just time to rush to the station and get the train, but I was wearing my most untidy clothes and I hadn't had time to have anything to eat and drink. So I was in quite a bad temper when I got to the interview. And I remember Commander Denniston asked me, amongst other things, whether I was at all air-minded. Well, I wasn't, and I said so. My two brothers were both very interested in aircraft, but it was a thing that had never appealed to me. And apparently, this bluntness was a thing which impressed the interviewers, and they took me on. I went first to the training course in London, and my first day on the course was actually my 21st birthday. After a few weeks, the course was transferred to Bedford, and it was in June 1941 that I moved from Bedford to Bletchley. The people that I met when I first came were people like Commander Denniston and John Tiltman, who was one of the greatest cryptographers. I never met Dilly Knox because he died very shortly after I came to Bletchley. I met Alan Turing because one time in our section, we had a mathematical problem connected with probability, which none of us could solve because we weren't really mathematicians. And we were told that Turing was the man who would solve it for us, and he did. He was a very shabby, untidy man. In all the published pictures, he must have been smartened up, I think, especially for the occasion. But his mind was absolutely brilliant. In the spring of 1942, Commander Denniston, who was in charge of the whole outfit at Bletchley, moved to London. He was moved rather like a queen bee taking a new swarm to a new place. And Bletchley was taken over by Commander Travis. In London, I worked under Norman Sainsbury, who was an expert in Oriental languages and later became the keeper of the Oriental manuscripts at the Bodleian Library in Oxford. We worked in an office in Berkeley Street, which before the war had been a hat shop called Peggy Carter, and some of the hats were still stored in the basement and in the attic of the building. And our fire officer was very alarmed because he thought that straw hats were just about the most dangerous thing as a fire risk that there could possibly be. And then there was an offshoot from Berkeley Street, where I worked for some time in Aldford House in Park Lane. I was working there for the most part on Japanese diplomatic ciphers. We spent hours and hours copying things out and shuffling things to and fro to try to make them fit. And it was a great moment when we actually made the break and were able to read the messages. I was working at one time on a Japanese code book, which had a limitation. There were four-figure groups, and each group, the first three figures, were either all odd or all even. And this enabled us to work out a pattern so that we could set the messages in depth, which made it possible to break them. And then we could take the differences between the groups and find common differences, which were assumed to be differences between common groups. And so we could reduce all the various columns of our table to the same base, as it were. And then it was possible then, from there on, to start breaking the code book itself. The Japanese commercial attaché in Berlin seems to have invented a little cipher which was really almost a childish thing. And when we were working on it, we thought that it was really perhaps not worth the trouble of doing. However, when other business was slack for some reason, we thought we might as well tackle this potty little thing, and did so. And we were told afterwards that the messages had been shown to Winston Churchill himself, because the Japanese attaché gave an estimate of the amount of damage which we had done to German cities in the latter stages of the war, saying what percentage of each had been destroyed. And our people found it very interesting to compare the Japanese report with the reports which our bombers themselves had made.
You've talked about diplomatic codes up till now, and now you're saying the military are making their own plans, so the military are using their own codes then?
Yes.
How are we going about breaking those, or are we?
Well, the short answer is we're not doing very well. The Japanese, since the 1920s, have been using a series of different naval codes, and we're talking principally about Japanese Navy. When I say all this, you have to bear in mind that there's army stuff going on in the background. People are breaking Japanese army codes, but they're not as important at this point. And the Navy are the main one, and they go through a series of progressively more complex systems. But unlike Purple or Enigma or whatever, the Japanese Navy is using a manual book code system.
Right. They're not using
a machine.
Machine. So
they're using an additive book cipher. This is the same as the Royal Navy is using, similar system, you know, same principles. The Italian Navy are using it. It's common.
Last month you were talking about the Italians using book codes at the start of the war.
So it's the same idea, and probably helpful to recap. How a naval book code works is you take all the words and phrases that you might need to put in a naval message, and you put them in a thing like a dictionary, a code book, and then you allocate to each word or phrase a random five-digit number. Some cases it's four digits, some cases it's five digits, varying on the codes. The one we're talking about here is a five-digit system.
And these have been around for years.
People have been using these since the turn of the century.
Yeah.
The Royal Navy's using them, as I say, the Italians are using them, the Germans used them for a bit in World War I. They're a very common encryption system because they're not bad. But equally, systems have evolved since World War I to how you attack these systems. So what you do is you turn your, whatever it is, HMS Victory will sail tomorrow, you turn those words into five-digit numbers. What you do then is you have a second book which has columns and columns of five-digit numbers randomly. And you find a particular column in the book or row in the book. You turn to a particular page, start on a particular line in the book, and then you take the random numbers out of your, it's called an additive book. Well, it's confusing. They're either called an additive book or a subtractor book, depending who you talk to. The principle is the same. You take that number and you add it using non-carrying addition to the number that you've got from your code book. And that produces a third number. Code number plus additive equals ciphertext. This process is called super-enciphering because the word has been encoded, in the strict sense of the term, into a number, and then that number has been enciphered by
the
adding
addition
an additive
of the addition.
These things get called subtractors because what you do at the other end, if you're the breaker, is you have to deduct that number again. They've used a number of systems, but by the time you get to 1941, they're using a system which, in the American sort of catalogue of Japanese codes, is referred to as JN-25, so Japanese Navy 25. And the British call it JN-25 as well. JN-25, as I say, has five-digit numbers, so if you've got five-digit numbers, you've got a possible 100,000 numbers. Actually, the Japanese books only use about 27,000 of those numbers. And the reason for that is they only use the numbers that are divisible by three. And their additive book, their book of random numbers that you add on, is also only 30,000 numbers long. What that means is when you produce your ciphertext, your cipher numbers, when you've added everything together, the result is divisible by three. And that provides what they call a garble check, means the person at the other end, when they're writing it down, if they write down a number that isn't divisible by 3, they know they've got it wrong.
Ah, right, okay.
That's all it does, which is quite useful, makes life easier for the code senders, but also it assists a code breaker because you know that, firstly, you've got fewer numbers to work with, and also if the solutions you create aren't divisible by 3, you know you've got it wrong.
Yeah.
And Edward Simpson, who did this stuff, broke JN25 at Bletchley. He died a couple of years ago, but we both had the chance to talk to him about it, and he explained all this much more clearly than I did.
In great depth.
The problem with book codes is the more your enemy can collect your traffic, the more and more of your additive book he will collect.
Is this what they mean when they talk about building up the book?
When they talk about book building, there's two processes in book building. Well, there's three processes. One is you have to recreate the additive book, which is the added on numbers. And there, you know that the numbers are going to be from 0000 to 999 or whatever. But you don't know what order they're in. But you do know that the order doesn't change. They're in a 30,000 number long list. In the book, they're printed in an order. And every message will start in a different place in the book. So theoretically, if you collected 30,000 messages, the likelihood is you'd have the whole of the additive book because they'd have all been used. And similarly, with the code book, if you use a code book for a long time, the more messages you send using that code book, the more material you give to your enemy to try and unpick it. The trick is you have to change both books from time to time. And the Japanese start out changing them relatively infrequently, but they get more and more frequent. In December 1941, we're on JN25B, and the B refers to the code book, the book with the word, the numbers that relate to the words. And also they're on about their third additive book. They have a new additive book in August, and they get another new additive book in December, just before the battle starts. On 4th of December, they introduce a new additive book. Useful thing from a codebreaker's point of view is if you know some of the code book, but the enemy changes the additive book, you can use your knowledge of the code numbers to start rebuilding the new additive book. And vice versa, if they change the code book, but they use the same additive book. So strictly speaking, you've got to change it both at the same time. And the Japanese do this increasingly frequently. By 1945, the US are working on JN25N and additive book number 70. So by 1945, they're changing the additive book about once a month. Or they're trying to.
Yeah.
The problem is, by that point in the war, they've got wireless stations scattered all over the Pacific. They've got very poor communications. Because the problem is, if you change the book, everyone who uses the book has got to get a copy of the book. And just policing the book management becomes really difficult. And, you know, you say, right, from Thursday, everyone will use the new book. Somebody gets a new code book and a new additive book. And then Fred Bloggs off in the Aleutian Islands doesn't get the new book, so he uses the old book. And then because if he's overlapped the books, he's compromised the system. And the Japanese suffer from this really badly towards the end of the war. But at this point, in 1941, JN25 is relatively new, and the British and the Americans haven't got very far with it. Because what you have to do, basically, is you progressively try and build the additive book, and you also progressively try and build the code book. In December 1941, both the British and Americans have only probably got about 2,000 of the code book words.
Out of
33,000. So it's a small proportion. I mean, actually, the ones you break first are the most commonly used ones. So you only need to break about 40% of the book to read 90% of the messages, because the other words are, you know, really obscure words that you don't use very often. The other thing that you do in these books is typically the word ship, for example. If you use the same number every time for ship, it would make the code easy to break. So common words like ship or harbor or gun or something will often have multiple numbers so that you don't use the same number every time. But that reduces the number of words and phrases you can put in the book.
It's like all codes and ciphers, isn't it? There's a compromise.
Yeah. And you also have numbers that represent letters of the alphabet, so that if there's a word that isn't in the book, you can actually spell it. And there's a code, numerical code that you put in that says, the next bit is spelling. And then you spell what you've said, and you put in the code that says, I've stopped spelling now, we're going back to words again.
Are these not all pointers to the code breakers?
They are. We sit here going, oh, the Japanese did this, Japanese did that. The British are terrible in the 1930s. What the British do is they have a book for the Merchant Navy, and they have a code book for the Royal Navy, and they say to the Merchant Navy, your messages aren't very secret, so you don't need an additive book. You could just use your code book. So they just send messages encoded, but not super enciphered. Then they say, oh, if you're going to send anything secret, here's the additive book from the naval code. And they add on the additives. But because the Germans know the base book, because they've been able to read it already, the Merchant Navy is sending very stereotyped messages because they're all leaving port today, arriving in Malta tomorrow. So the British are really bad at this. And there's a point when the Royal Navy say, if the message is very important, don't super encipher it, which is criminal. Yeah. But yeah, so in 1941, both the British and the Americans are trying to book build JN25. So they can read some of the words in some of the messages, but not all of them by any means. And what happens after the Sinkoff visit is the Far East Combined Bureau, who are the British guys in Singapore who are breaking this stuff, are told you can now collaborate with the Philippines. And so the US and the British codebreakers, who are both separately working on JN-25, send the words they've got in their collection to each other and they swap results. And of course, there's quite a lot of overlap, but equally, they both got words that each other didn't know. So they give themselves quite a boost by sharing. And this continues the rest of the war. And by the time you get to 1945, for example, the team here at Bletchley that Edward was in, because the Japanese are changing their books so quickly, Bletchley's working on some of the books and Washington's working on other books, although it's all part of the same JN-25 system. But at this point, they're not seeing very much. The messages they're reading, you know, you get one word in 10.
It's not great help, is it?
It's not a great help.
I was surprised but very pleased to be asked whether I would lead the team that was going to work on one of the biggest of the Japanese naval ciphers, which was called JN-25, JN for Japanese Naval. I think it's just worth mentioning courses in Japanese language. Of course, nobody in the cryptanalysis business needed to understand the full subtleties of Japanese language. What we needed was the language of Japanese naval signals, which was very different. Obviously, once Japan came into the war on Germany's side, there was going to be a need for Japanese linguists. Bletchley Park had a few who were already well into the Japanese language, but that was nothing like enough. The School of Oriental and African Studies in London told Tilghman that it would take 2 years to train up a linguist for his purposes. But Tilghman hadn't got 2 years, but he got advice that it could be done in 6 months. He got Captain Tuck, who was presumably already a buddy of his and had long experience in the Far East, to come and take charge of the course. And he then approached tutors in a number of Oxford and Cambridge colleges who recommended to him young men who might be able to take on this challenge. And they and Captain Tuck came together in Bedford and embarked on the 6 month course. It was a huge success and a tribute to the judgment that it could be done in 6 months. I mentioned just as one illustration of the success, Marjorie Dale was the only woman on the first of these. Sometime later, her opposite numbers in Washington were so impressed by her skill that they took for granted that she had grown up in Japan. And when they were told that, no, she'd done a 6 month course, they were lost in admiration. The team that we set up to work on the JN-25 cipher was, in the first instance, entirely people who had been in the Italian section, and very much the younger ones. We were not starting entirely from scratch. JN-25 was, again, basically a subtractor system, and so it had a good deal in common with the Libya, which we had worked on in the Italian section, and that was a good start. And of course, other people, particularly the Americans in Washington, the outfit called OP20G, and also people in Australia, were way ahead of us in experience. We were never going to be their equal, that for two main reasons. One was simply the number of persons that we had at our disposal. One of the senior Washington US Navy people, Commander Wenger, was in Bletchley Park in July of 1943 at this formative time, and he told Bletchley Park that they had 700 people working on the recovery of JN-25 alone, and that they hoped to raise this to 1,000. Our party started with 20 and stayed at 20 for a year, and the biggest we ever got after we were able to recruit, as people gradually became available from the European war, was 45 was our maximum figure. So clearly we were not in the same game as Washington. Our second limitation was on what we technically called the traffic, that is the enciphered messages as taken down out of the air. The British receiving station at Flowerdown, in spite of the distance halfway around the globe, was able to record a certain amount of Japanese traffic, And that was great, but it was less than a fifth of the total available. The large quantities of traffic recorded either on the American West Coast or even in the American Pacific Islands came to us in paper form by diplomatic bag about twice a week, but 2 or 3 weeks late. And that was, of course, a huge handicap which we were never able to overcome. At one point, I remember, we said to Washington very politely, would you like to cable us the raw material, and then we could get it hugely sooner, to which, and I'm sure they were entirely justified in this, they said no. So we were stuck with this situation on the supply of raw material. Now, it's obvious that where there were chunks of this material that could be fairly easily solved, Washington would themselves have solved it long before the raw material ever reached us. Cable was used to exchange recovered, solved additives. So we didn't waste our time starting on what we knew they had already solved. What we couldn't foresee, and this sometimes did lead to disappointment and frustration, was that we might have what we considered a very good day and recovered a lot of additives and sent them off happily to Washington, saying, in effect, look what we've got, only to find that the following day, their cabling, their recoveries to us would include what we had just found and a lot more besides. And you couldn't help being disappointed by that. But, you know, we swallowed it and carried on.
If the Allied codebreakers are only reading, as you say, maybe one word in ten, and the conspiracy theories are Roosevelt must have known what was in these messages, what did they break and what could they read and what specific warnings were there? Were there any that they could read?
Well, this is where we get to the sort of the heart of the matter and the really kind of nitty-gritty of it. And there are things that can be read on the diplomatic side, but the naval side is much more difficult. So as we were saying earlier, the big strategic piece is better understood, but the specifics of the day are worse. But even in terms of the strategic position, there was information available about the fact that America might get attacked or Britain might get attacked. Where and how is not clear, but that it might be imminent is potentially detectable. And this comes about because the Japanese, as I said, have sent a delegation to Washington to negotiate for at least a temporary, you know, truce. They have been told by the Japanese government, go to Washington, but if you don't get anywhere by the end of November, something will happen automatically.
But they're not told what?
They're not told what. But they're told, get on with it, because if you don't do a deal, don't expect to hear anything else. The next thing you know is something will have been done. But then on the 6th of December, which is the Saturday, a message is picked up, a 14-part message, a really long message in purple is picked up, or part of it is picked up on the 6th, to the Japanese diplomats in Washington, laying out a whole series of negotiating points. It's essentially an ultimatum for the Americans. And that Saturday happened to be the Army's Day breaking purple. I think the first 13 parts of the message are picked up on the Saturday and broken by the Army. The last 14th part turns up on the Sunday morning and is broken by the Navy, but all 14 parts still make it to the State Department and to the US government. The Japanese plan was that the Japanese diplomats would prepare this message. They have a meeting in the State Department at 1 p.m. on the Sunday. And the idea is that they will turn up at the State Department and they will hand over this message because the emperor had said, we cannot make a surprise attack on the U.S., the Japanese emperor. We must declare war first. We must obey the diplomatic niceties. So the idea was they would go to the State Department. They go, here's an ultimatum. And then 45 minutes later, Pearl Harbor, bam.
Yeah.
The problem is that the Japanese diplomats spent so long breaking the message themselves, decrypting the message, and then typing up a smart in English copy. The text is actually in English for delivery to the US government. They spend so long sorting out their copy that they're actually late to the State Department. So by the time they get there, the attack has already happened.
Ah.
And they basically get chased down the corridor of the State Department.
Yeah, this is the meeting with Secretary of State Hull, isn't it?
Yeah, Cordell Hull. And the other thing that's sent out in purple traffic is a warning to Japanese diplomats overseas to be ready to destroy their cipher equipment.
Which is never a good sign, is it?
It's never a good sign. So these warnings are there. And you imagine it's Sunday lunchtime in Washington. Everybody's home for the weekend. And it's like, blimey, something could be kicking off today. But we don't know what it is.
It is very, very last minute.
It's very last minute. And Admiral Stark, who was Chief of Naval Operations in Washington, and he goes, right, I need to make sure everyone's at readiness in case they're attacked by the Japanese. And then his reaction in connection with Pearl Harbor, he goes, we've been bugging Pearl Harbor that they're about to be attacked by the Japanese for weeks now. You know, sending them another message today saying, you might be attacked by the Japanese, isn't really going to tell them anything. At that point, it's still the middle of the night in Hawaii. So he's going, I'm not going to wake up Admiral Kimmel, who's in Hawaii, to tell him he might get attacked because he's just going to put the phone down on me. Because there's no specificity about it. It's just a general warning that American assets should be on the alert.
They've been sending these sort of messages out from Washington all that summer, haven't
yes.
they?
Yes. Pearl Harbor is already on the highest alert it can be on a sustainable basis.
Yeah.
You know, you can only be so alert for so long. They're as alert as they're able to be already. You could describe this as a specific threat, but it's not that specific.
It's kind of the boy who cried wolf,
yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly. A lot of the aircraft in Pearl Harbor are Army aircraft. And General George Marshall, who's the Chief of Staff of the Army, he's got less of an excuse because he spends Sunday mornings riding his horse. And he comes back from riding his horse and he reads all of this stuff and he goes, blimey, the Army in Pearl Harbor need to be told. Or the Army all around the Pacific need to be told. So he goes, right, we need to send out a warning. But it happens to be one of the days that the atmospherics over the Pacific are just dreadful for wireless communications. So they can't actually reach Hawaii on wireless. Because it's just chance yeah. one of those days that the atmospherics are wrong. So what he does is he gets his guys to go to the Western Union office and send them a telegram saying, you might be attacked. But, you know, again, there's so little detail in what they're suggesting that there's not much that, no. even if those messages had successfully reached Pearl Harbor. I mean, the two guys in Pearl Harbor, the Army and the Navy commanders, are sacked subsequently because the way their aircraft were positioned on the airfields and the way they were using their radars and all sorts of things, they weren't as prepared as they should have been. But that's a different thing from
receiving a warning.
Receiving yeah. a warning.
From my knowledge, the cooperation between the Army and the Navy in Pearl Harbor was probably as good as the cooperation between the codebreakers in the Army and Navy, wasn't it?
Yeah. And they also have this problem that they, you know, they've been warned that their aircraft could be attacked by fifth columnists by terrorist attack on land. So basically, the way you solve that is you park them all in the middle of the runway where you could walk sentries around them. But actually, that puts them in the perfect place to be shot up by bombers. So you're kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. So basically, the purple traffic, the diplomatic traffic, on that Saturday and Sunday prick a lot of people's ears up. They go, blimey, something could happen today. This is a bad day. But it doesn't say anything that it's going to be Philippines, Guam, Pearl Harbor, and Malaya. It's just, we need to be ready for whatever might happen.
This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. This is CBS in America calling Honolulu. Go ahead, Honolulu. We should like to now try to call in Manila, the capital of the Philippine Commonwealth. Go ahead, Manila. This is CBS in America calling Manila. Go ahead. We regret that we are unable to contact either Honolulu or Manila. We return you now to William L. Shirer in New York.
Now, we've called this episode Easterly Wind Rain. Is this where this is going
to
come in?
It is, yes. I was waiting for you to ask me why I'd called it that. These messages are quite famous. They're quite controversial because some historians argue that they were never sent. Other historians say they were sent. But I'll give you the what may or may not have happened, if you like.
This became latterly more controversial, didn't it?
Yes. I don't think it's particularly controversial because I don't think it adds much to the terms of warning. But in short, the procedure was that the Japanese were worried that their diplomatic missions overseas would be caught on the hop by the start of the war, because obviously they've not been told what the military preparations are or anything. They're working kind of blind. And they were worried that their communications with their diplomatic outposts weren't secure enough or good enough that they could tell everybody in time for them to be ready. So what they decided was they told everybody to listen to the news, the normal Japanese broadcast news.
Radio
news. And they would insert special phrases into the weather forecast in the news that would tip off their diplomats what was going to happen. The point is, though, that the tip-off was very general. And this is why it doesn't really give warning of Pearl Harbor per se. Because there were three weather forecasts that were the secret messages, if you like. The first was easterly wind, rain. I've got it in Japanese here, but I won't attempt it.
No.
And if a diplomat heard that, that meant that the Japanese were going to do something against the United States.
Right.
And that's all it says. Doesn't say you're going to attack Pearl Harbor. Doesn't say you're going to attack the Philippines. Just says, we are going to do something against the Americans. The second message was west wind clear, which meant they were going to do something against the British, which means an invasion of Malaya or Singapore or Hong Kong, whatever. But again, completely general, no detail, no specificity. And the third one was north wind cloudy, which meant something against the Soviet Union. Because from northern Manchuria, there's a shared border. They've had a war in 1939, briefly, along that border. So one of the Japanese expansionist options was to push up northwards into Siberia. So basically, it's saying to the diplomats, is it USA, is it Britain, or is it Russia? And that's what the diplomats are briefed to expect.
These are included in weather forecasts on the radio news from Tokyo. Are these unusually worded to normal weather forecasts, or are they...
I have to admit, I'm not enough of an expert in what a 1941 Japanese weather forecast sounds like.
No.
In terms of whether this is the case or not, it's not implausible.
I mean, some of the controversy has probably been helped by that fact.
Yeah.
That, yes, there could have been other broadcasts that use similar language, and therefore, oh, well, oh, they must have known, and it doesn't take much for a conspiracy
theory.
Again,
I can't claim to be a massive expert in all this material, but the research I've looked at, the books I've read, are pretty clear that these messages were at least intended to be sent. And Mick Smith, in his great book, The Emperor's Codes, he talks about all of this. His version of the story, well, I'm inclined to trust Mick Smith, he's a good guy. His version of the story is that the first two messages, east wind rain and west wind clear, were actually picked up by the British in Hong Kong. In the little Y station they had left in Hong Kong, even though FECB had moved to Singapore 2 years before, they still had a few interceptors in Hong Kong. And that these guys on the Sunday pick up those two messages. When I say the Sunday, that's actually the day before in Hong Kong. It's still the 6th in the United States. So those guys, they're kind of reading their own death warrant because Hong Kong is attacked on the 7th and falls very quickly. So there is a strong suggestion that those weather messages were sent and that the British picked them up. The point is, even if the British know what they are and they share the information with the Americans, it's still completely nonspecific. It says, we're going to do something against the Americans, we're going to do something against the British.
And also, at such short notice, what can you do?
What can you do? Yeah, exactly. If your fleet's not there, your fleet's not there. No. There's nothing you can do in that time scale. Interestingly, the other thing on the 7th was the Japanese put, we have declared war on the United States, as a headline in the evening newspaper in Japan. But by that time that came out in Japan, it was a couple of hours after the attack had happened. So again, these messages, they say, watch out, America, you might be about to be attacked. But in no way do they say Japanese Navy is about to bomb Pearl Harbor. They just don't say that. So whether or not they were actually heard by the British or the Americans, or whether they were even transmitted, is kind of moot.
It stretches it quite a lot to go from this really non-specific, we're going to attack the United States, or a United States
asset somewhere in the world,
to Roosevelt knew the Japanese were going to attack on December the 7th, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, again, to give you a modern parallel, all of the controversy and the conspiracy theories that surround Pearl Harbor, you can say exactly the same thing about 9/11, because there's all this, you know, did the intelligence services know? Did they deliberately keep it a secret? You know, and the answer is basically, in so much of what we talk about, that intelligence is not perfect.
No.
And intelligence is often vague and it's often incomplete. And yes, it helps, but it rarely gives you a simple answer.
And it also depends on the analysis that you can do on it.
Yeah, and it's all about nuance. And, you know, so, you know, it's like nowadays we have a terrorist threat level, but because it doesn't describe an actual, you know, they're going to blow up London Bridge, it's kind of useless in a way.
That's like the example going back to them sending out warnings to Pearl Harbor all that summer. Yeah.
Yeah. So on the diplomatic side, even with the winds messages and even with the purple messages that they get on the Saturday, there's nothing in there that I would say really that the Americans could have done much about. I mean, Pearl Harbor could have been more ready, but Pearl Harbor could have been more ready anyway.
Yeah.
And that's not down to the SIGINT, that's down to the commanders in Pearl Harbor.
Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning. The anti-aircraft guns began barking during a blackout ordered by the 4th Interceptor Command at 2:25 a.m. The unidentified object, which some sources thought might be a blimp, moved slowly down the Pacific coast from Santa Monica and disappeared south of Long Beach. Army officials declined to comment on the possibility that the object might have been a blimp.
What about naval? Is there anything in naval, or are they...
The interesting thing about the naval isn't how little the British and the US knew from naval traffic, but how clever the Japanese were in making sure they knew very little.
Right.
Because although I've said that JN-25 breaking was in its infancy, they're reading one word in 10. They're still intercepting the messages. And this is where traffic analysis and direction finding and things come in.
Because when your enemy's about to attack, you expect their traffic to increase.
The traffic to increase. Also, you can do direction finding. So if a signal comes from a particular ship and you listen to it in two places, you can triangulate and you can work out where that ship is. There's also the two techniques I think we've talked about before, which is operator's fist. You know, somebody's tapping out Morse code and you can tell who the guy is who's sending the Morse. Yep. And also radio fingerprinting, which is where you look at the electronic characteristics of the signal, because all radio sets are microscopically different and they all give a slightly different signal. So even if you can't read the messages, using wireless fingerprinting and direction finding, if the Japanese fleet sailing to Pearl had been sending wireless messages, the British and the Americans would have been able to identify that a fleet was in that particular location and probably which ships were in it.
Were they not?
Surprisingly enough, no. But they go further than that. The Japanese Navy launched the whole operation under complete radio silence. So those ships sail from Japan out towards Hawaii without sending any wireless messages at all, which is the first step. But they go further. They realize that the British and the Americans will be listening for the Japanese Navy to be sending messages.
Yeah.
So even just a sudden lack of messages would be a bit of a giveaway. Yeah. So what they do is they take both the wireless operators and the crystals out of the wireless sets on the ships that are going to attack Pearl Harbor, and they leave them in Japan, and they put them on little patrol vessels, and those ships sail around in Tokyo Bay, sending dummy wireless messages, pretending to be the Akagi and the Hiryu, you know, the fleet carriers, and the Americans are doing all the DF, and they're doing the radio fingerprinting, and they're going, yeah, the Japanese carriers are all still in home waters, because look, here's the DF, here's the intercept.
That was really clever thinking, wasn't it?
It is, and what I think is important about it is, often in the story of signals intelligence and Bletchley Park, you can become very Allied-centric and you can talk as if what the Allies do is somehow better or cleverer than those silly old Germans. You
know?
And we talk about deception operations as if they were a really clever British idea. And, you know, they're busy making yet another film about Operation Mincemeat at the moment. Mm. It's in the cinema scene. The Allies aren't the only people who know this. You know, anybody who's got any sense in the wireless world of the 1940s knows how to do deception operations. And equally, they're doing their own DF, they're doing their own WTI. All of these approaches and techniques are shared by all the belligerent powers.
Yeah.
So the fact that the Japanese are running a deception operation shouldn't be that surprising. And actually, that they run a particularly good one. And it's not that the Americans fall for it, but the problem you have is you say, oh, the diplomatic chatter tells us that a war is likely. What can you tell us about the Japanese Navy? Are they doing anything weird? And the response comes back, well, as far as we can see, they're doing the same thing they're always doing. They're stooging around Japan, sending out normal traffic. And so it's not as if the code breakers have been deceived into believing something different. It's like all the best deceptions. They've been deceived into thinking that everything's still normal as it will be every day. And that's where the Japanese really get the jump on them.
The world today. The Columbia Broadcasting System now presents a summary of news to this moment on the war with Japan and other world-fighting fronts, reports by CBS correspondents in the war zones, and the minute-by-minute developments as received by Columbia's newsroom here in New York. And now, John Daly.
First, the highlights in the war news. Berlin reports Japanese troops have crossed Thailand's border and have started a drive on the Burma Road. The report that Japanese troops have landed on Lubang Island in the Philippines is not confirmed. The island of Guam is reported still in American hands. Manila has had new air raid alarms, but no bombings are reported, and it's believed Fifth Column action may have been responsible. The latest CBS message from Honolulu says Hawaii is calm and morale high. The latest claims of the Japanese High Command reported in propaganda broadcasts from Tokyo describe destructive air raids on Malaya and a land attack on both Singapore and the British colony of Hong Kong. But the British say all these attacks are being resisted successfully. No confirmation yet as to whether the Nazis intend to declare war on the United States or whether Hitler will address the Reichstag as rumored.
Basically, everything you've explained, David, says to me that there wasn't really a specific warning at all, was there?
There wasn't. The warnings that are available are so general and, although they get shorter and shorter term, even when you get to the point of saying there might be an attack today, which is a possibility on the Sunday morning,
the Pacific's still a big place.
Pacific's still a big place.
Yeah, I think that's something we, I don't know if we take for granted or we don't take into consideration, but the theatre of operation is enormous compared to, you know, even if you include the full extent to the Germans getting all the way to Stalingrad and North Africa, it's still tiny in comparison to the Pacific, isn't it?
Exactly. And the fact that the US War Department can't even communicate directly with Hawaii on the day, just because the technology just isn't there. The idea that you can just send someone a text or whatever just is a real problem. And whatever the SIGINT people know, even they know very little, just communicating that information around. And, you know, if the British had listened to the WINS messages, conveying that information to the Americans, the channels just didn't even exist, even if the willpower existed. So I think, you know, in some ways, case closed. Pearl Harbor was a surprise attack. I wouldn't say there was a failure of signals intelligence. Nobody made a cock up on the day. You know, there weren't messages that were missed or whatever.
There isn't a message that says, we're going to attack Pearl Harbor on December the 7th and someone didn't send it through to Admiral
Exactly.
Kidd.
That's not the case. That intelligence simply did not exist.
And although on the morning of December the 8th, things were very bleak for both the British and the Americans, ultimately Pearl Harbor isn't a success, is it?
It isn't. As I was saying at the beginning, the absence of the American carriers and the limited damage they do to the battleships means that the American Pacific Fleet has not been destroyed. And the moment it hasn't, the Japanese have basically lost the war.
And a lot of those battleships that they do sink, they actually refloat.
They refloat them, yeah.
They also, bizarrely, do not destroy the fuel oil supplies that are at Pearl Harbor, which are 6 months' worth of fuel for the whole Pacific Fleet.
And if they destroyed that, again, the US fleet would have been out of the game. And it's quite striking that within 6 months you have the Battle of Midway. And again, there's a SIGINT component to that, which we will talk about next year, probably.
Yes.
So look forward to that, listeners. But by Midway, you know, the tide has turned. And it takes another 3 years of very grim fighting to bring the Japanese to their knees. But almost immediately after Pearl Harbor, they're not going to win. It's just a question of how long it takes them to lose. The other thing that I think is really important here is the relationship and the collaboration. The fact that the Americans have given the British a purple machine, which is running here at Bletchley Park. The fact that the Philippines and FECB are talking to one another. It's the birth of this relationship that we've been talking about all year between the UK and the US, which, although they're both on the back foot at this point, that relationship is getting going and will only get better.
You say we've been celebrating that this year, David. We have. We've done a few episodes with the podcast. We started off right near the beginning of the year talking about Sinkoff and we looked at Brucer. But you've been cheating on me, haven't you?
I have. I've been talking my talk elsewhere. What we've made this year are a series of four films. Full-length documentaries. Each one is
they're
40 minutes long. They're a good long watch. They're all going out on YouTube. And what we've done there is we've looked at the developing signals intelligence relationship between the UK and the USA, starting way back in the 1930s.
And this isn't just you, is it?
No, we have David Hatch, who's another great Dave, who is the historian for the NSA in Washington, D.C. And so what you see in the films is I present the UK perspective on the story and David Hatch presents the US perspective on the story. So you can see how the two sides, not only how the historians have told the story, but how the two sides felt about each other from their own perspective. I really enjoyed watching that because I tell the story my way, but listening to David tell the story his way. There are certain aspects of the story, like Midway, for example, which is much better from his lips because he knows it much better than me, whereas I can talk about the Easter Sunday raid, for example, which is the British side of the story. I commend them to our listeners if you want something to watch on YouTube or indeed put on a listen to because it's mostly me and Dave talking. By the time this comes out, they will all be available on YouTube.
And that's the Bletchley Park channel on YouTube. Or you can find links on any of Bletchley Park's social media or the website.
World War II saw the US and UK form a very special relationship. Working together and sharing intelligence that would significantly help towards a victory. An alliance that continues to this day. But how did it all begin? To piece together how it happened, historians and experts from both sides of the Atlantic examine the course of history from their perspective. They'll take us through the breakthroughs of intelligence.
Intelligence and security that protects the West is mostly born out of this collaboration, and it's not created easily.
The challenges and obstacles along the way, and the code-breaking techniques and successes.
Perhaps the most important attribute that shaped this early relationship was patience. But patience paid off
and a glimpse into the world of the Codebreakers themselves.
It's pretty fantastic if we have a look inside.
A little collection of photos of a baseball game which took place at Bletchley. It doesn't really get much more American than baseball.
So enough of the plug for the video, let's get back to the audio, and I'll forgive you for cheating on me. So are we blowing all of these conspiracy theories out of the water?
We kind of are, but we haven't really covered them all yet.
Are there more?
There are more. One of the problems with the history of Pearl Harbor is the incident was mired in controversy from day one. And again, the analogy with 9/11 is quite strong because this is putting words in people's mouths, but Americans like to feel secure. The idea that their country can suffer a catastrophic attack without anybody knowing about it or any having any advanced knowledge of it creates a sense of weakness in people's minds that makes them uncomfortable. Since December 1941, there has been a need among some people to somehow explain away how America could be surprised so badly. And the US government was very concerned. There were 9 official inquiries into Pearl Harbor before 1946, and they had a 10th one in 1995. So they've been going over this and going over this and going over this for years. And even the 1995 one, which was supposed to be called the final inquiry, hasn't really stilled any of the debate. And William Friedman, who we talked about, who's a very famous American cryptographer, he made a lovely remark in the early 1960s when he said, "The Battle of Pearl Harbor is still being fought, but the adversaries this time are all Americans." And we have looked at some of the I would call them the slightly saner conspiracy theories, which are, could the SIGINT have informed the US Navy, the US government?
The main ones I know are, Roosevelt knew that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked. Churchill knew Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked, but because he wanted Americans to join the war, he didn't warn them. I mean, they're the two main ones I know.
They're the two
of.
Main ones. The problems with those are, in terms of the theory about Roosevelt, he was pro-British. You can make quite a strong case for him wanting to draw America into the war against Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
And that war has been going on for 2 years at this point. So I think that's less arguable. But how a war with Japan helps with that is difficult to explain because it undermines the US's ability to help Britain against Germany. The war against Japan doesn't really help anybody. The Churchill argument really falls down because I've already explained the massive overstretch the British have. Whether the price of getting the Americans on board against Germany is worth the trade-off of having to fight the Japanese yourself. The last thing the British want in 1941 is a war against the Japanese as well. They're already fighting the Germans and the Italians, and the Royal Navy is already overstretched all over the place.
And we don't want to lose Malaysia. We don't want to lose Hong Kong. We don't want to lose Singapore. Yeah, we don't want to lose India.
So I don't think the idea that Roosevelt or Churchill or any of the politicians in the situation were wishing for a war with Japan and covered up signals intelligence. And in any case, I'm a historian. I work on evidence. I say, if you think that's the case, show me the evidence. And there just isn't any. It's a theory. And a theory without evidence is just that, a theory.
It doesn't take much, you know, for a conspiracy theory to start, does it? You know, it actually takes lack of evidence many cases.
A nice absence of evidence.
Have we got any others then?
There is one, a really Bletchley specific one, which is equally rubbish, is when Leo Rosen builds his purple analogues, he builds something like 6. And one goes to the Philippines, 2 are in Washington, D.C., and I think it's actually 3 that are sent to the UK with a sync officer. The point is that a purple analogue is not sent to Pearl. So the American code-breaking operation in Pearl Harbor, specifically, doesn't have a purple analogue. There is a, albeit mad, school of thought among your more Anglophobe Americans who will argue that the purple machine that should have been sent to Pearl Harbor was sent to Bletchley Park. And as a consequence, Pearl Harbor couldn't read the Japanese messages, so they couldn't get the warning about being attacked by the Japanese.
Even though they were sent the warning about being attacked by the Japanese.
Yeah.
That didn't exist.
Yeah. It's nonsense, but it's out there. And separating the wheat from the chaff is really, really difficult.
And also because it's been such a controversy for so many years. I mean, me and David were actually talking about this before we started recording. In the last year, I've listened to 3 audiobooks, which are big tomes about Pearl Harbor, about this very subject, and all 3 of them had different conclusions about who was to blame for the debacle on that day. And it's just a great thing to come up with a new book for, isn't it?
Exactly.
They know they're going to sell.
And it's like so many stories in military history that the truth is probably quite boring. It's not a conspiracy. At best, it's a cock-up. And even if it's a cock-up, it's a shared cock-up. There's no one person you can go, he was to blame.
Yeah.
It was him. Put him up against the wall. And people want those really concrete answers. They want to be able to say, this person did wrong. Observant listeners will have noticed that there are points in this story where I don't know the intimate detail. The reason for that in some ways is that life is too short to research Pearl Harbor because there are so many books on it. And you have to be really careful about which books you read because a lot of them are written by nutters or by conspiracists. And it's just not that simple. You can argue that Washington on a Sunday morning wasn't ready. You can argue that Pearl Harbor wasn't ready. You can argue all sorts of things. But at the end of the day, the biggest conclusion you can draw from Pearl Harbor is that SIGINT isn't perfect. Intelligence will only hint at the answer. Mostly it's incomplete. Mostly it's ambiguous. And mostly it will only get you half the way there. The rest is luck.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate, of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.